The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Like, talk to more people that were going to come to this.
I don't think the room's big enough. I'm going to get started because I teach, but just to introduce everybody, we have Professor Carl, who teaches in the labor law area. Professor Wiley, who teaches in the health law area. And I'm Nancy Abramowitz, and my connection is I teach pension and employee benefits law, which is largely labor law. I'm going to speak quickly because my pension class is on this afternoon, and I want to catch the faculty meeting, too. Basically, I encourage any of you who has any interest in labor relations, or health law or anything in the benefits area to consider thinking about structuring a course load in your upper level courses that would put you on a trajectory for a job in the area that you might be interested in. I urge you to think about the fact that with careful planning, I think you can probably design a curriculum that makes you pretty marketable. For example, in the pension area, we teach a very sophisticated course, one that's not taught in many JD programs, and I think it gives students the flexibility to go market themselves, not only as new hires, but as saying, take me, give me a chance, because I'm the equivalent of 1 or 2 years experience. I have had that exposure. And I think that's probably true in the health area or the labor area as well. In order to do that, you need, again, to think about planning your course load accordingly. In my area, there's only one course that's a pension course, but, yeah.
Do you have the exact name of that course?
I do. It's called Pension and Employee Benefit Law 745.
And are you going to teach it in just a moment?
Yes, and I teach it every spring.
What? Oh, in the spring.
I teach it only in the spring, every spring, and I usually teach it during faculty meetings, but on Monday and Wednesdays, usually from about 4:30 to 6, to sort of catch people in both the day and the evening program. It's a great course. It's a little bit of tax. It's a little bit of labor. It's a little bit of health. It's a lot of administrative law, a little bit of bankruptcy, a little bit of trusts, and it's basically the rug of the Big Lebowski that ties it all together. And it's a fun course to take, too. So I urge anyone who may be interested, or if you're interested in any of these other areas, well, Jennifer can tell you whether it's interesting or not. If you're interested in any of these other areas, this is also a nice complement to that, because it's hard to understand health law without having a very basic knowledge of ERISA, which is the pension and employee benefit statute. While I was touching on the areas that I think our course touches on, I would also urge you to think about building out a course load that includes some of those courses as well, because if you're interested in the pension area, you really need to understand administrative law. Bankruptcy is a good thing to have. Yeah.
Are there any requirements before you take that course?
Absolutely not. Okay. I would urge you to think about some general sorts of courses. I'm going to stop because I think Professors Wiley and Carl are probably going to share with you some of those general courses also that have some bearing.
Okay, well, I'll just pick up on the labor and employment law theme. My name is Susan Carl, Professor Carl, and I teach in the labor and employment law area. So I teach employment discrimination generally, but I'm on sabbatical now and next semester. I designed the labor and employment law curriculum so I can explain how it's supposed to work. I can tell you about the courses that are going to be offered in the fall and in the spring. And I'm also hoping I invited Professor Owen Hernstad, who's an adjunct, who's teaching the International Labor and Employment Law course, and I invited him to come. He may not be here right at the crack of 4 o'clock, but he's also doing a tech-in, a sort of teach-in for the Wisconsin collective bargaining situation at 5. And Jennifer, who made a brief appearance, who is the head of the Labor and Employment Law Society, can tell you more about that when she comes back in the room. So I don't want to yak on and on, and I also want to give Professor Wiley time to talk about the health law curriculum. I'll just say that the way we redesigned the curriculum recently, and I'd love feedback on it, for labor and employment law, we have a, here's Jennifer. Jennifer, we need you.
Oh, sorry.
I was talking about the tech-in.
Yes. Oh, there's a very lovely event that's happening in this room at 5 o'clock.
Yeah, okay, so it'll be here at 5.
Yeah.
So labor and employment law, for a lot of reasons that I can tell you if you're interested, but I won't go into it in case you're not, we now have an introductory course that's labor and employment law combined, and that's going to be taught next fall by Harold Datz. There are a bunch of people who teach it. And the idea is to give you exposure to both labor, which is collectively bargained, collective employment rights for the ever-shrinking number of workforces in the U.S. that are unionized. But it also, that aspect of labor law is very important in understanding employment law generally, the backdrop of it. So it's sort of some basic labor law combined with employment law, which is the term one generally uses to talk about the legal rules and regulations that apply in non-union workplaces. Okay, so it's labor and employment together. It's the introductory course. And then we have two other courses. One is employment law, advanced issues in employment law, and the other one is advanced issues in labor law. And you don't have to take the introductory course in order to take the two more advanced courses. You know, it's up to you, but you'd have to do a little catch-up. Those are the others. So that's sort of the core of the labor and employment law. Then there's a whole other separate area, which is employment discrimination, right? And that's its own course, and that is becoming more and more complex. There's also disability rights, which has a lot of employment discrimination, a couple of gender and the workplace courses, which also have employment discrimination stuff, employment law in them. So there are a variety of things we can take, but I won't. I'll wait for your question. It's called labor. It should be called employment and labor law. And I just saw it on the schedule here. I just pulled it up. I tried to get a printed out copy, but we're now paperless in the registrar's office, so they wouldn't give me one.
I have one to give you, but not here. You managed to get one out of the registrar's office.
Yeah. I'm looking it up right here. It's taught by Harold Datz. Here we go. Employment and labor law. That's what it's called, and for some reason I still have it called the employment relationship, but it is the basic course. And Harold Datz, for those of you who don't know him, is a very long-standing, he's now retired, lawyer who was, you name it, he was general counsel at the NLRB, when I was practicing labor law, he was the head of the Office of Advice at the NLRB. He knows more labor law than almost anybody else in the country. So he's a great person to take, but he teaches employment stuff too, and I've seen his syllabus. I think it's more heavily weighted to the employment than the labor law. So you could do that in the fall. And I'm happy to answer other questions. I don't know what you all are here for, and I don't want to blather on about stuff you don't want to know.
They're here for me. Actually, but how does these apply to our students?
I have that strong feeling. Of course, not because she's my student.
I don't want to keep going
if this is in the labor and employment law crowd, which I think it's not because I would know you probably. But anyway, I'm happy to answer other questions about the labor and employment law curriculum. Yes?
Sorry.
Oh, yes. Okay, so when Professor Hernstad comes, if he's able to make it, we have just added this course, and it covers the kinds of labor and employment law issues that arise through international trade agreements, bilateral agreements, multinational agreements. He covers the ILO standards, the International Labor Office standards, which are, you know, voluntary standards that employers can sign, can agree to, that are designed by an NGO, a non-governmental organization with some quasi-governmental powers. So he covers that. There's a wonderful new casebook out that you could probably get from the library. If not, you can stop by and I'll lend you my copy very briefly that will show you the kinds of things you cover in that class. But it's covered, it's the international law regarding labor and employment. And he's been teaching that for a couple of years now. I hear great things about it. Probably not going to get you your first job out of law school, but it will certainly inform the work that you do in many domestic law locations. And it's a very, very interesting area of law. So I highly recommend that course. If, especially if you're interested in international law, human rights law, any of that kind of stuff, that it's a really great course. And Professor Hersett is a very expert authority. He works for the Machinists Union, and he does, that's what he does day in and day out, is work on the international aspects of labor deployment issues. All right, moving on to health law.
Do you want to make sure there are any, if you need to head out?
Yeah, I do need to take off. Are there any other questions?
Because I can't answer questions.
Oh, okay, so you'll be around. Right. Great.
You and I have got to answer questions.
You can answer questions from a student perspective,
yeah,
but in terms of what a professor would say, I think I wouldn't want to turn it over to you because I don't know which courses.
I can always tell you to go ask her later.
So I am on sabbatical, so I'm almost never here. But feel free. Yeah.
Do you recommend taking any courses like admin or anything before taking this?
There's really, the dean's office has really has a policy of trying, and I think this is a really great idea. We try not to have a lot of prerequisites for our courses, because even if you already have a background in the course in the area, going over some of the basics will only help.
Okay.
And so we try to catch people up to speed so that you don't have to, you know, go through the sort of lockstep progression of courses. However, I would say that if you're interested in labor and employment law, taking ad law at some point during your legal career, I think, is really important. And the other course that I would say is really important is business associations, because it's all, after all, what you're doing is working with employers. And so understanding how American business, the law that applies to American business, is absolutely crucial. Even if you're a human rights person and really you're into it with the civil rights part, right, the human rights part, you still do need to understand how corporate America works, so I would really encourage you to take that class. And if you want a job, I would take Professor Abramowitz's class, because if you like it, you know, the ERISA stands for the Permanent Employment, the Full Employment Act for Lawyers. It's very complex, and people who can do it are really in high demand, which is true of a lot of areas of complex regulatory law. This is something that we were just having a faculty meeting, and I'm sure Professor Wiley will agree, and health law is like this too. You know, there's so much new regulation in both of our areas, and so lawyers are needed to interpret that for clients. And so to the extent that you can get comfortable with highly complex regulated areas of law, you're creating job opportunities for yourself. Yes. Yes.
The question that I always get from students is, what is the difference between the employment discrimination course and the people of employment discrimination people?
Okay, I
guess. Both are being taught in the fall.
Yes. You could take both of them. So they cover some similar material and some different material. And I've known Professor Yuo. He was one of my first mentors when I first graduated, or first started working. I worked at the Justice Department in the Civil Rights Division. Appellate section, doing a lot of employment discrimination work, and he was the deputy assistant chief in the employment discrimination section. And he is one of the key architects of one of the key aspects of Title VII, which is the disparate impact area. And so he has designed, and he teaches now in our clinic. He's retired from the Justice Department. He was one of the whistleblowers in the Justice Department. And Civil Rights Division was really becoming very political and very there were some corruption issues going on in terms of hiring and stuff.
Which is why I can't say that I worked for the Justice Department.
Yeah, so he was a whistleblower, and so he was, gestured out of his job managing the employment discrimination section and retired, and he came here. And he's a lovely person who knows a lot, and he teaches this course, which is based on actually litigating a case. And it's a case involving gender discrimination and disparate impact, and the firefighters of he was the head of the team that sued fire departments around the country for having physical performance requirements that almost no women in the country could meet, and trying to work on changing those requirements so they still captured what you actually do need to be able to do physically to be a firefighter, which is very hard and which still most women in the country can't meet. But so to have a fairer way of selecting firefighters, so it focuses on disparate impact and gender discrimination. And it kind of works on a case model approach, so you actually have a case and you're working through the stages of litigating the case. And along the way, you learn a lot of employment discrimination law. The employment discrimination course is a survey course which covers everything. It's twofold. I teach that course. I love teaching that course. I'm not teaching next fall because I'm on leave, but generally I teach it. It covers everything from race discrimination, sex discrimination, national origin, discrimination on the basis of religion. It covers the Americans with Disability Act, which is disability-based discrimination. And if you're interested in disability issues, you might also want to consider taking Bob Dinnerstein's disability discrimination course, which covers some employment stuff and some other stuff. It also covers age discrimination, and I always include the soon-to-be, we all know, new federal laws protecting against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, the gender identity status, and all of that. So it's a very, and I do now, I do a unit on some international issues as well, some international approaches, CEDAW and stuff like that. So it's a different course. It's a survey-based course. It covers topics that UGLO's course doesn't cover, but it doesn't go into the same depth that UGLO's course would go into. And well, just because she's in the room, another hidden resource for employment discrimination and employment law is Avis Sanders, who is the director of the externship program and also just happens to be an employment and employment discrimination lawyer herself. And so if you're looking for jobs, she's a person to go to get some advice.
And if I could just jump in. I'm going to bring over in a minute some copies that list out for you the employment and employment discrimination externships that are listed in our database. You can take a look through that. And then you can go, this is the externship program database, not the OCPD database. And you can go look through that, and you'll see all the various people who have taken externs in the past who do employment law or employment discrimination law.
Avis, do you have copies of the externship list for HOPA as well?
I do.
This is for both.
Oh, okay.
And I know you have a great list.
I do, and I'll go make some copies of that too, and then I'll bring it back in the next 5 minutes. Okay.
Try to integrate. So the theory of practice come together.
There really are amazing externship opportunities in both of these areas.
Any more labor or employment related questions? And then I'm going to turn it over for the main question.
I was just joking because I sent my tort students an email to ask something to come. Okay, shoot me emails if you have further questions.
So I'm here on the panel to discuss the health law curriculum here at WCL. But before I do, I just want to add my voice to those Professor Paul and Professor Abramowitz and singing the praises of taking employment and labor law courses, and especially ERISA and pension law courses while you're here as a student. There are ridiculous numbers of jobs in ERISA, even in this economy. It is an area that if you can develop an expertise and an interest, it does make you incredibly marketable as a lawyer. And incidentally, if we've talked about admin and business law, business associations. I think both of those are also excellent courses to take if you're interested in health law. If you're interested in sort of the ERISA side of things, tax would be the other big part of that. ERISA is in some ways a specialized area of tax practice. So I teach torts to about half of the people in the room. And I also teach the health law survey course, health law and policy, in the spring. Historically, we've also had an evening option taught by an adjunct, and that the scheduling of that hasn't been finalized yet, but we expect that to be offered as well. So there are two sections of the health law survey course that are offered. And then we historically have had about six subspecialized courses in health law offered each semester at WCL. So we have an incredibly broad and rich curriculum in health law here. So there are 12 sort of regular semester-long courses generally that you can take in health law. And then we also have a summer institute that goes for 2 weeks in the summer where you can take some intensive one-credit courses that are in specialized areas of health law. And we bring in some really fantastic adjuncts to teach those courses. And there are brochures for that over on the side here, as well as some other brochures and a flyer for an event that Professor Abramowitz asked me to tell you about. It's a sort of career opportunities in ERISA event, and they've actually got the Assistant Secretary of Labor coming just to speak to WCL students about career opportunities in labor and employment in ERISA law. So in terms of kind of specialty areas in health law, we have it's a lot. And in some ways, the diversity of the curriculum can be a little daunting in terms of figuring out what your interests are. As was said earlier, I also don't think you need to take any particular prerequisites before taking the health law survey course. Admin law is very useful, but it's not actually something that you need to understand before you can get a lot out of the survey course. The survey course, I mean, the way admin law works is sort of that in the survey course, there are certain areas, I'm sure for employment law as well, and labor law as well, where you can sort of highlight this is where all the admin law stuff comes in. And for those in the class who already know it, it kind of pulls together then. For those who take admin law later, you know, as long as you've kind of highlighted for yourself where in the survey course for health law or employment law or environmental law, those admin law process-focused issues come into play, you can then it can pull together once you're taking the admin law class instead. Health law in the survey course is a really nice opportunity to pull together strands from various courses that you've taken in your first year. We do a fair bit of torts, but also a lot of contract law and constitutional law in sort of the health law survey course. And it's also a nice way of getting a sense for which specialized areas of health law you might be particularly interested in. Because at least my survey course is really designed to give you, it's almost like a semester-long advising session in the different areas of health law that you might explore further, and in both in terms of career opportunities and in terms of taking sort of subspecialized health law courses. So I can answer any questions that you might have. We can talk about the specific classes that are available and kind of what the different maybe clusters are within the health law offerings here. Let me give you an opportunity to ask questions. There actually is tea in the cup this time.
Yeah, do you want to just go into some of the categories, just so you were talking about that a little bit?
Sure. So rather than just list off the courses title by title, right, which you can do by looking them up in the course listings, there are a few kind of key clusters, right, of course offerings. And I think probably the dominant one in terms of practice opportunities is going to be healthcare regulatory compliance. You might think of it that way. And a lot of the health law survey course is really going to fall into that regime. But regulatory compliance means everything from complying with federal privacy regulations, health information privacy regulations, to fraud and abuse law, Medicare and Medicaid fraud and abuse law, to accreditation standards that are really done through even non-governmental organizations that accredit hospitals or like, as well as kind of state regulatory bodies that license practitioners. That's the kind of the main area of health law private practice. Within healthcare, you can also look at some subspecialty courses within that. So we have a course offering, for example, in health information technology and privacy. So things like electronic medical records and the privacy regulations that govern how those are maintained and how they're shared among providers and others. And then we have other specialized courses within that on things like business transactions, fraud, and abuse could kind of fall under that as well. And then there are also sort of there's another way of practicing health law or of studying health law that's much more focused on the business aspects of the healthcare industry. And you would take many of the same courses. You would still be taking courses on regulatory compliance, for example. But you would also want to take, we have a course that's offered in the spring called Business Transactions and Fraud, I think it's Fraud Prevention. The healthcare industry is subject to some specialized antitrust law requirements, for example, and also a lot of the fraud and abuse laws that are intended to, that are sort of federal laws about referring business from federal programs like Medicare and Medicaid. A lot of those laws actually dictate the kinds of business arrangements that doctors and hospitals can enter into with each other, for example. So that's really a way of practicing health law that's a much more sort of transaction-focused practice, more like corporate transactional work would be. You could also do sort of practice health law in a way that's really much more sort of focused on traditional tort law liability. So we have a course, for example, on medical liability, taught in the fall by Steve Pazner, who's a really great adjunct. And those are the people who are either representing plaintiffs in medical malpractice cases or defending institutions and other healthcare providers in medical malpractice. And that's an area that a lot of private firms have a practice group devoted to as well. Aside from healthcare, we also have a lot of courses that are quite different. So, for example, you can study bioethics. And there's a whole group of lawyers, people with JDs, who study health law, who ultimately go into something that doesn't really look like traditional legal practice, but rather they work at a hospital or at a research university doing various things, sort of serving on hospital ethics committees or institutional review boards to maintain the sort of compliance of the research and also patient care functions with ethics principles, with federal regulations that regulate research participation, sort of rules regarding how research subjects have to be consented and what you can do, what has to be sort of done before a major new kind of research on human subjects project can be approved. They also, from the hospital standpoint, focus on patient care. Bioethicists do a lot of things associated with allocation of scarce resources, deciding, helping physicians resolve potential tensions over whether a patient should be, how a patient can be listed with organ donor databases, for example, or how to handle difficult situations surrounding the treatment of premature infants. So some really highly exciting kind of cutting edge stuff. But that's not what most health lawyers do. I mean, that's the stuff that a lot of students come in wanting to learn about. But there are some jobs, but not as many as in these more regulatory aspects. And then there are also, we have courses that are international in focus. We have health and human rights. We have international organizations in public health. And we may eventually add a global health law course. That looks really different from kind of healthcare focus. Law and policy, it tends to be focused more on issues that are more kind of population level instead of focusing on the interactions between doctors and patients or hospitals and patients or insurance carriers and patients. They're really focusing more on the health impacts of corporate practices internationally, for example, access to medicines, reproductive justice, and those kinds of similarly, there's a course that I teach called Public Health Law that looks at some of the same types of issues, but domestically, focusing more on access to healthy living conditions as opposed to access to health care and treatment for illness. So those are kind of the basic areas that we have, although some courses would fall into more than one. And I tried to structure that in terms of the kinds of practice that you might go into, the things you might do after law school with that training and background. Any other questions? Yeah.
How do you go with some of the things and how that works?
Like, are there prerequisites for the, do you have to take the first class to take the second?
No. So I'm not aware of any prerequisites actually for any of our health law course offerings. So, as Professor Carl said, there's sort of an ethic here of avoiding prerequisites if at all possible. And I think that actually works quite well. The summer courses, you can really pick and choose. It's like a buffet. You don't have to take them in a particular order. Some of the courses are offered every evening for a week. Other courses are offered for two full days on a Thursday and Friday, or I think there might even be a Friday-Saturday course. Most of them are pretty narrow topics. One of them, Health Law Fundamentals and Healthcare Reform, is sort of more of an overview. But I wouldn't take it as a substitute for the survey course. It's more of a sort of get a taste of various things. There's Introduction to Medicine for Lawyers, which is meant to be sort of an interdisciplinary kind of thing. Health and Human Rights, International Health and Human Rights, Healthcare Fraud and Abuse. There's an Introduction to Bioethics, an Introduction to Genetics in the Law, Pharmaceuticals in the Law, and Healthcare Compliance and Governance, which is sort of an overview of that regulatory practice that I mentioned. Along the same lines, you might also think about if you're interested in more of a sort of policy-focused career in health law, food and drug law would be a really great addition. I mean, you could also just sort of pursue a career in food and drug law and take only those courses, but courses like food and drug or disability law can actually be really useful even if your primary interest is in health law to you. So you can sign up for those for credit, and again, the brochure is down here if you want to pick it up on your way out. I think, let me see the dates this summer, it's at the end of June 20th through June 30th, for 2 weeks. Any other questions?
Can I jump back in? Since I didn't really say much when I was here before, I realized I should probably give a little bit more of an explanation. So if you're interested in health law or in employment law, either and or both, one of the best ways of figuring out what exactly you want to do is to get some work experience in the field. And you can do that this summer. You could also do it in the fall, the spring, next summer, next fall, next spring. So I'm giving you a list of places, but if you find something on your own, and you want to get credit for it, then you should come to us and talk about it, because as long as it meets our requirements, you can do that. And in terms of like creating a career for yourself, say in health law, you know, it's a combination of which courses to take and then getting out there and meeting people and doing the work. And so that by the time you're done and you're graduating, you have like sort of a complete picture on your resume of between the coursework and the work experience and the supervision and the networking that you've done and the people you've met. So it's really, it all ties together. One thing to do whenever you're talking to somebody who's in the field of either health law or employment law, ask them. Say, when you're hiring, what experience are you looking for? What coursework are you looking for? They may not even realize that there is coursework because not every school offers this many courses, like in health law, you know, or in employment law. So they may actually be surprised when you say to them, oh, well, I've taken, you know, whatever. So just to be aware that it's all part of the picture. You don't want to do the work experience without taking any coursework, and you don't want the coursework without the work experience, and it's all part of the same thing. If at any point you want to chat about any of these things, obviously the work experience part of it, feel free to stop by my office. I'm in room 411. And on the employment side, I did practice employment discrimination law, so I have, you know, some additional information about that field as well.
And I think that's hugely important to take advantage of the externship opportunities here in D.C. for either of these fields, and really for any field that you ultimately decide you're interested in. I think it's one of the big advantages that WCL students have going on the job market. Not only are we in D.C., but among D.C. schools, we have just this incredibly well-developed externship program. So I think that's really important to do that, and also to look at taking advantage of our clinical opportunities, too. We have one of the best clinical programs in the country. And I think one of the things that you should definitely be thinking about is what is that resume going to look like at the end of my time here, or even, you know, at the end of my second year when I'm looking for summer positions.
And externships can be a big part of kind of pulling together the various strands of an area that you're interested in.
Did you have a question?
Oh, I was just going to ask if you have any advice about how many classes you can take in the summer. Would it be imprudent to take 4 credits?
It would. Yeah, I think it might. You might be limited to 3. You should check on that to be sure, but I think that's right, that you can't take more than 3 in a summer. I think it's a really nice opportunity to add, you know, a specialized course to sort of what you can do during the year. And I know that often you feel like, well, I only have so many credits to juggle during the semester, so it can be a chance to kind of take something else. It can also, a lot of students at here, I think, use both this summer institute and the other summer institutes, we have several, to kind of lighten their load a bit during the semester, which can be, I know the first year is incredibly challenging in a lot of ways, but the challenge in the second and third years is that once you add these 20-hour a week externships and clinics that are incredibly time-consuming, it can be hard to also keep up with your doctoral courses. And so some students, I think, will take summer institute courses to lighten the load during the regular semester. But I think you have to balance that with, you know, summer jobs that you might have. I think in general, I wouldn't advise depending too heavily on the summer institute courses, because just by virtue of having to be very short and intensive, it's not quite the same experience as you'll get in a regular semester long course. But it can be a nice way to sort of distribute your workload a little more evenly, and also to have a chance to kind of explore something new. They tend to not be quite as demanding per credit in some ways, would be one way of putting it. You write a paper at the end. Some people who you'll be in the class with are there for CLE credit, and they actually aren't writing a paper. And you have a fair bit of time after the course ends to finish your paper. So it's a nice kind of low-risk way of exploring a field that you might be reluctant to explore during the regular semester. That said, in some of them, you end up spending, you know, like 7 days in a classroom. I mean, 7 hours in one day in a classroom, so it can be...
I was wondering, those two-day ones.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that. I don't think they've finalized the schedule for sort of what's offered when during those 2 weeks. But most of them, I think, are offered over the course of 4 evenings or 5 evenings. A couple of them are intensive 2 days. I taught the Health and Human Rights course last summer, and I think we all try to kind of break it up with some experiential learning, sort of things like simulations. And so it's not. I mean, it's not 7 hours of lecture. At least I hope the other courses had 7 hours of lecture. I certainly wouldn't have done that. Yeah.
Kind of along that same line, it's not like a normal class where they're questioning us the whole time.
No. I mean, I can only speak. I've taught some, and I've also watched a couple of others, and I'm friends with several people who are teaching. And no, if anything, one of the difficulties of the Summer Institute is that in the past, some people are coming in for CLE credit, it's hard because only the academically engaged students have done the reading, for example, and some students sign up for it at the last minute and haven't done the reading. So I don't want to perpetuate that problem by saying take a summer course, you don't have to really prepare and do the reading, but it's not 7 hours of being questioned intensely. In some cases, the expectation is that you do the reading after the class session in preparation for your paper. But again, I hesitate to say that because I don't want to then like make it exacerbate the problem by having told you that you don't really need to do that reading. I can't believe I just said that. Advising session. Don't tell anyone.
Podcasted.
Yeah.
I was just saying it's podcasted.
Is it? Great. Thanks, Melissa. No, it's a wonderful opportunity and to explore some really interesting subjects. Yeah.
How does that work with taking like other summer classes? If we're doing that?
Yeah, the summer institutes are staggered so that you can participate in more than one institute. That said, I think there is still maybe a limit on how many credits you can take during the summer. You'd have to ask someone else about that, though, because I don't actually know.
But I know there are, like, semester-long
summer-length courses. as long as, I don't know how, whether there's sort of a cap then at that point that, or how that would apply, but I mean, obviously you couldn't sign up for an institute intensive course that conflicted with a course you were already signed up for. I don't think the system would allow you to do that. But in terms of the sort of separate institute, intensive institutes, they're staggered so that they're not scheduled at the same time. This place is actually pretty lively over the summer for a law school. There's a lot going on, and a lot of people coming in from outside of DC for various programs too. Any other questions? Nobody really listens to the podcast anyway. Okay, well, I'm happy to answer emails from any of you as things come up. And Corinne Parver, who was, sorry she couldn't be here today, is also, she sort of is the primary kind of academic advisor for people interested in health law, but I'm happy to talk to any of you as well. I have to go to the faculty.
I would definitely get the extra check. Okay. It basically just lists a huge number of organizations in the DC area that do homework, and a lot of them you wouldn't necessarily think of.
Yeah.
So I would definitely look at that. Even though it's meant for externship programs, it gives you contact information.
Yeah.
All of them too. No problem. Just send me an email to let me know if you got an interview so that I can expect a call. Thanks. Good luck. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow.